You are listening to the Friends of Fantasy Benefits Baseball Podcast. We will be coming to you each and every day with uncensored, in-depth analysis of everything you need to know to win your fantasy leagues this season. You can follow us on Twitter, at Fantasy Benefits, or join the Facebook discussion groups, www.facebook.com/groups/Friends of Fantasy Benefits. Give us a 5-star review on iTunes and send us a copy or screenshot of it to friendsoffantasybenefits@gmail.com or on Twitter at Fantasy Benefits for a chance to get into one of our listener leagues or other prizes. Enjoy the show. Are friends with fantasy benefits.
Mike, how hard are you right now?
Oh man, I've been hard since you said hi, welcome to Friends with Fantasy Benefits podcast.
Well, that was great before like that introduction.
We are friends with fantasy benefits.
We're renting a house somewhere in Manhattan. And we are going to crash Tout Wars.
We're busting through the doors with a boombox, and yeah. We're just going to let it ride.
We are friends with fantasy benefits.
Names for them. We have Good Mike, which is Mike Gianella, and we have Evil Mike, which is our Mike.
I feel so bad about this, too, because I didn't come up with this. Like,
we are friends with fantasy benefits.
Welcome to episode 199 of the Friends of Fantasy Benefits Baseball Podcast. I am Justin Mason, lead fantasy writer and analyst for friendsoffantasybenefits.com. Joining me on this episode are Mike Warner and Matt Thompson. Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing fairly well. I don't want to give any alternative facts, if that's what you're asking. If you guys get that, no. But yeah. It's been kind of crazy last few days. We, lost yet another baseball player, which is just tragic, and I hate even reading that and seeing that type of stuff. So, my, deepest condolences to Yordan Ventura and Andy Marte's families. It definitely sucks. And the Rays made a big trade today, too. It's been a whirlwind of thoughts and emotions.
Yeah, it really has. We'll definitely cover the Rays trade here a little bit later in the show. Matt, how are you doing?
Good. First of all, like Mike said, thoughts on all the Kansas City Royals fans with Ventura and Andy Marte fans out there. I remember Marte was a can't miss prospect with the Braves, so that goes down to my prospectness there too. But no, it sucks. Losing a member of your favorite team is no fun. I can speak for that. But I guess now I'm just lamenting over how many innings Brad Anderson throws this year, and I don't see how there's any way it's under 200 because he signed with the Cubs. So.
I'm not even going to touch that one. Again, yeah, I'll echo you guys' sentiment about Ventura and Marte. Especially Ventura, 25 years old, entering the prime of his career. It's really sad. Marte, just as sad, not as impactful in terms of professional baseball or fantasy baseball, but still sad for a 30-year-old to lose his life, both of them to lose their lives, especially in the manner that it happened. So thoughts and prayers out to their families. But on a more joyous note, we have a very special guest, our good friend Mike Gianella from Baseball Perspectives. Mike, how are you?
Well, that was great before like that introduction. I mean, I obviously don't mean to minimize what you're talking about. I was out on Sunday. I was at an event, and I heard about that like way after, because I was not on social media most of the day. So yeah, I was kind of floored by that. And it's funny, the same thing happened with Jose Fernandez. And on that day, I was out running, and I got back home, and I saw that news. So yeah, it's always shocking, and it really saddens you when something like that happens. But yeah, that's your question. I mean, beyond the obvious sadness of that and of Marte, I'm really excited. We're coming up on baseball season. We've got a lot going on at Baseball Prospectus. We're at the beginning of second base week there on the fantasy side, which is a little bit confusing because on the analytics side, they're in pitcher week. which I don't know if you read that today. There was a whole article about command versus control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is awesome.
Yeah, it's from an analytic perspective, it's like some next level stuff. So, you know, if you're not a subscriber, this is like a great time to get on board.
Definitely. We love all your stuff you guys do over at BP. And we have one of our staff writers just got picked up by BP Rickeyville. Darius Austin is writing for them now. So we have a little connection now with BP.
That's cool.
And Mike, why don't you tell people where you reached on Twitter? And then if you want to plug anything of yours specifically, feel free to do so.
It's just Mike Gianella, which is my name, all one word. Last name is Gianella. Right now, I am primarily at Baseball Prospectus, although I am doing an interesting venture. Eno Saris, as many of you know who follow him at Fangraphs, he's starting another venture with a beer online magazine. I wrote an article for that.
Nice.
And nice. I'll be heading out to this Thursday to the event there. Mm-hmm. Over in Brooklyn, and unfortunately I don't have any of the particulars in front of me, but I'll try to find that before the end of the show. So one of the things I don't make resolutions, but one of the things I wanted to do this year was to branch out into more writing, whether it was non-fantasy baseball writing or just any kind of writing. So I'm really looking forward to the article that I wrote for him. I can tell you it's a piece about Smokey and the Bandit and the role of Coors in that movie, which was the beer tie-in. And I wrote a little bit about the history of the beer, and I wrote a little bit about the movie. Nice. Particularly for people, I'd say, under 30 who might think that movie is a museum piece and how it still resonates. And I'm really excited to see that drop. So that's the other non-baseball thing I have going on. But yeah, right now we're at the heart of fantasy baseball season. And about 20 articles a week coming out at BP. I've got like two of them. And it's just, you guys know on your end, too, with your site and what you're doing. This is just an exciting time.
It really is. Yeah, I keep trying to get Eno to see if they're willing to hire a full-time addiction specialist, because it seems like that's something they might need, and me being that's what I do during my day job. I thought I could be really helpful, but he refuses to answer my tweets.
Not everybody has a problem, Justin. Jeez.
Not everybody, but some people definitely do.
Oh, man.
For those who've never heard Mike on this podcast, Mike Gianella, when he's come on this podcast, it can be very confusing having Mike Warner and Mike Gianella on the same podcast. So if you've never heard that before, we have nicknames for them. We have Good Mike, which is Mike Gianella, and we have Evil Mike, which is our Mike, and very apropos.
I feel so bad about this, too, because I didn't come up with this. Like, I probably, you're from Michigan, right, Mike?
No, I'm from Florida, and I live in Nashville.
I probably been like Florida Mike and Pennsylvania Mike, or...
Just Gianella and Werner. I mean, it could be as simple as that.
It's way more fun to do it this way.
I wanted to go with Good Mike and Dickhead Mike, but that's not good enough.
That's why we have our uncensored rating.
Exactly, right? Climbing back up the rankings, one swear word at a time.
Yeah, right?
So that's how I'll reference you guys in case you have forgotten. So let's jump right into our main topic. We're going to talk about some recent MLB moves here in a little while. But first, since we have... Good Mike on, and he is a former winner of Labor and Tout Wars. We wanted to talk some auction strategies and kind of go over that. So let's start off with kind of a simple question. Good Mike, what percentage of your budget do you tend to spend on hitting versus pitching?
Well, the last couple of years, to start with, I'm in the draft in Labor and the mix side, so the auction... as far as the expert experience would tie back to Tout, I tend to budget about 68 for hitting, 32 for pitching. The last couple of years I've spent more on the pitching side in Tout, in part because after the Aces, people tend to discount those pitchers and don't spend on the mid-tier guys. And in 2015, oddly enough, I snuck in Kershaw a little bit more cheaply, and I won. Last year, I didn't get an ace, and as good as the hitting was, even though I didn't spend a lot on it, pitching is what killed me. And, you know, Adam Wainwright was the guy I spent the most on. It didn't work out, as we all know. He wasn't awful, and he rebounded. You know, and when I say wasn't awful, he wasn't awful in an only. But he did, you know, screw me in the sense that because he was the guy who was my centerpiece, he didn't even break even. He didn't, like, emerge back to his old form. So while I do budget a certain way and try to spend, you know, try to spend like 30-32% on pitching, I tend to go where the auction takes me. And Tout the last couple of years has really been aggressive on the hitters. And I've been willing to build out, like, kind of a balanced team. And to give you an example of this, and I wrote this in my recap of Tout, even though I was one of the lower spenders on hitters, I think I spent about 163 on my offense. Coming out of the auction, I had the second best offense. Only Todd Zola, who won the league, had a better offense. So you can do that. You can spend less on offense and still succeed. The problem kind of comes the other way, like with pitching. There's so much volatility that putting that much money into your staff, unless you bank on an ace like Kershaw or Scherzer, you know, just use the animal only as an example, it's kind of a risky proposition.
All right, Evil Mike, what are your thoughts on this?
You know, I you know, pretty much agree. I start off with like a 70-30 budget for the most part, but it all kind of is relative to whatever draft I'm in and, you know, how the auction is kind of going. I have valuations on every player, and I also have, you know, certain benchmarks I want to hit in terms of my projections for the team and the players that I'm drafting as well. So, I mean, at times, especially if, you know, one of the pitchers that I have valued at a certain mark, you know, is, you know, only being bid up to a certain amount and it's, you know, $6 less than what I have him valued at, and I end up acquiring him there, then it might end up, you know, me kind of, you know, steering clear of my 70-30 budget and, you know, going more towards the 60-40 mark or whatever. So, technically, I try to stick with 70-30-ish, but a lot of times it can end up going either way. So, you know, for the most part, I stay fairly hitter heavy, you know, pretty much like a lot of people do, but I'm also somebody that kind of likes to let the auction or draft come to me as well. So it just is really based on whatever draft or settings I'm in.
Yeah, I tend to go for more of a 75-25 split when I'm first kind of starting out, but it's very fluid throughout the draft. So I like Mike said, like Evil Mike said, I tend to let the auction kind of come to me in terms of how much money and where I'm spending it. And so there's been plenty of times where that is it has definitely come much closer to a 65-35 split as opposed to a 75-25. And depending on what kind of strategy I'm employing, it could be drastic towards the hitting side. I'll talk about one of my favorite kind of out-of-the-box strategies a little bit later that involves spending very, very little on pitching. Matt, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I'm going to have to agree. I mean, I promise we didn't rehearse these answers before we did this. I tend to lean toward you, Justin. I go the 75-25 is my initial plan. But, I mean, as the draft gets going, there's always end up in the middle rounds. I mean, the middle tier players, and I load up on my hitters there. And then as the bottom of the, you know, we get deeper into the auction comes, there's a lot of pitchers I end up liking, and I end up beating closer to 60-40 than I would like. But 75-25 is where I start, but it never unfortunately ends that way for me.
You know, I'll just add to all this, like, you know, because there's different league sizes, I'm approaching my auctions just because Tout and my home league and there's another expert league, the CBS league, those are only leagues. Mm-hmm. I would agree in a mixed league that 75-25 or a higher hitting split is more appropriate. You know, just to let your listeners know, like in a mono format, the 70-30 or as I said, 68-32 is better. In a mix, because there's so much variability with pitching and so many things can happen at the bottom, I'm perfectly fine with that. I'm also fine with loading up with that 25% of putting a lot of that into an ace, mm-hmm. and going cheap with the rest of it. I don't know if you guys agree or not, but I completely agree. Can see in a 12 or 15, even a 15 team mix, 25% on pitching if you're doing an auction is fine.
I feel like there's a lot of pitchers going later that are easier to, you know, there's a hell of a lot of bargains late. But if you do that strategy, load up on a Kershaw or a Syndergaard or a Bumgarner or a top.
Well,
you can come back later with an NL only with, you know, quality guys at
yeah. selection. Yeah, and in a mix, it's just the variability. Like the top 20, 30, maybe, like, when I say top 30, I don't mean pitchers. I mean overall. Like, those pitchers within the top 30 or even top 40, there's not much variability. You know, a guy like Kyle Hendricks might break through, but for the most part, we know those guys are. But then when you get to the middle or the bottom, there's so much variability, and there's so many things in a 12 or 15 team mix that can change. It's kind of like, well, you know, why should I spend 30-35% on my pitching when I can get a free agent or, you know, somebody for a buck who's going to be like my second or third starter? It just doesn't make sense to load up on pitching budgetarily, you know, for guys that are just going to be out there as free agents.
I mean, especially in like a 12 or a 15 team mix, there's a lot more left over after the draft on the waiver wire as opposed to in your 10 and 12 team mono leagues. It makes a little bit more sense because you can definitely use your fab to kind of make up for a deficiency in the pitching department. Whereas I think that's harder to do on the offensive side and impossible to do in a AL or NL only.
And I realize we're jumping ahead, by the way, on one of your bullet points,
no,
but
totally
we can talk about it in more detail when we get to that.
Well, why don't we skip right to that one and then we'll go back to the next one after that. What are the differences for you, good Mike, in terms of your mono league strategy versus your mixed league strategy? You said, you know, you might spend more on the hitting side percentage wise than the pitching. Any other kind of tips that you tend to employ in mixed leagues versus mono?
Well, in general, so the pitching's one thing. This has changed a little bit just because steals are at more of a premium. But in a mixed league, a guy like Billy Hamilton or D. Gordon, you know, someone who only or mostly provides steals, I cut those guys down a little bit in mixed. I want to try to get contributions across the board in a mixed league. You know, or I want to get a guy who is doing everything but stealing, like someone like Manny Machado is a good example. So, like Billy Hamilton, like I really like the guy. I'm high on him. I've had him in labor and mixed two of the last 3 years, but I don't want to take him too far up the chain. You know, I know that Mike Podhorzer of Fangraphs is kind of on the other end of this, and he really values those steals guys highly. But if a guy like that doesn't work out or if he doesn't steal the bases, he does almost nothing else. Whereas, you know, a power guy, if the home runs drop, he's still doing something for you in the other three categories you expect him to contribute in. So that's one piece. You know, closers, I tend to devalue a little bit more in mix for some of the same reasons and just because the roles change. And, you know, especially in a shallower mix, you can just churn those closers constantly. The other thing in mixed versus mono, so in mono, I want to make sure you're chasing volume in mono. You know, someone like Freddie Galvis, you know, people laugh at him in a mixed league, and rightfully so, but in an NL only, you know, those home runs and steals he contributed last year, even with the bad batting average, those are huge. You know, in a mixed league, even a 15-team mix, he was kind of borderline. He was on and off a roster most of the year. You know, you played matchups with him. You know, you played him in Colorado or you know, somewhere where he might be stealing as a weak catcher. NL only, you had him in your lineup every week. Mm-hmm. So, you know, only leagues or mono leagues, you're playing volume. You want a lineup that has, like, you know, regular everyday players. Mixed leagues, don't worry about that so much because, you know, almost everybody except for your second catcher and two catcher leagues is an everyday player. So you're really looking there for not just the at-bats, but for the contribution. Now, a good example of this is, you know, Martin Prado. Martin Prado in an only league is gold. Like he's a guy where it's like he plays every day. He hits well over 300. He does a lot of home runs and steal a lot of bases. But, you know, he contributes in runs and runs batted in and average. Mm-hmm. So he's gold. You know, in a mixed league, he's – even in a 15-team mix, he's kind of borderline. Like he's a guy where you're like, okay, well, I need the average and I get that. And I don't want to have the other end of it where I've got a 230 hitter – who's, you know, only hitting 20 home runs and, you know, only like scoring this many runs. But, you know, would, like a corner, for example, between Chris Davis and Martin Prado in a 15 team mix, I'll take Davis and I'll suffer with the average just because there's so many guys that can make that category up for you. you know, or is it an only league if, and I guess another point, you know, average and paying attention to that batting average, I pay attention to that more in a mono than I do in a mixed.
All right, Matt, what are your thoughts on this? Is there anything you change based on mono versus mixed leagues?
Yeah, specifically with guys that steal bases. In a mono, I'm kind of the opposite of good Mike over here. I think in a mono league, I think I'm going to pay a little bit more money for the Billy Hamiltons of the world just because it's a bigger category like that. But like in a mixed league with a lot of, you know, other options, like you could pay, they'll be a little cheaper and they'll slide down to the bottom. You can get, you know, little stolen base guys like Reggie Davis or as part of and only those, like a guy like Reggie Davis is going to go a lot higher and be in more demand. I think a guy like him will fall through the cracks. You know what I mean? Stuff like that. Like the one category guys are easier to, obviously way easier to target in the bigger formats or in the smaller formats. So that's my thoughts.
Evil Mike, what are your thoughts on mono versus mixed?
I definitely assume a lot less risk in mono formats as I would in a mixed league. You know, for the most part, especially me, I'm somebody in mixed leagues that I go for the ceiling. I'm trying to build a juggernaut, and I'm willing to, you know, take as much risk as it takes to, you know, get as many guys on my team that are going to, you know, flourish, and, you know, just not really worrying about the age or the injury history as much and all that stuff. And I'll use my last, you know, few dollars or my last, you know, few rounds to get some prospects that might come up at some point. I'm definitely in for the risk there. But in mono leagues, I assume a minimal amount of risk. I just don't like to, I don't do a lot of stars and scrubs like we'll talk about. I stay fairly even in terms of my budget. And I just like to really look at, acquiring a lot of at-bats, playing time, like, Mike Janelle already said, just, you know, those guys like Martin Prado, Freddie Galvis, guys that are going to get the playing time, might not be flashy in terms of the stats they're putting up, but in especially in mono formats, just getting that playing time, getting those innings, getting those ratios just is really important to me. So I stay more risk averse in mono leagues and I stay, you know, fairly risk heavy in mixed formats.
And I think that's a really good point that you just made there, Evil Mike, because I completely agree with you. I'm much more likely to take big risks and go for huge upside in a mixed league rather than in a mono league. Mono league, I tend to want to spread the wealth. I tend to want to get some safety. I want the volume, like Good Mike was talking about. I want to make sure I'm getting a certain amount of at-bats, a certain amount of innings pitched from my offense and my pitching to make sure that I'm able to compete in all those spots. Sure, I'll take chances here and there because that's how you win leagues. But I'm a little bit more risk-averse in the mono leagues as opposed to the mixed leagues.
I was just gonna say I agree with that. I mean, like you said, for the obvious reasons, you know, the replacement level player in the in mono leagues is easier to find on the waiver wire than, or harder to find than the, you know, the mixed leagues. So I agree.
Let's talk about the stars in scrubs versus a balanced approach in auctions. Evil Mike, you kind of brought this up. When are you more likely to go for a stars and scrubs approach versus a balanced approach?
An extreme example would be your 10-team leagues, you know, especially with auctions. I'm willing to, you know, post big money on Trout, Kershaw, you know, all of the top guys, and then, you know, just fill the rest of my team with a bunch of replacement level value. And, you know, as the season goes on, whatever I need to churn and burn with is completely fine, because for the most part, replacement level is completely fine in a 10-team league, even in 12-team formats as well. Once you get into the mono leagues, I find it a problem because, you know, especially on the, you know, on the offensive side of things, just the at-bats are so important. And I know something that, you know, a saying that you always say, Justin, is, you know, at-bats are currency, especially in mono formats. And, you know, whenever I'm kind of looking at my budget when doing the mono formats, I always make sure I have enough offense and I can fill my roster. If I were to go stars and scrubs in a mono format, I would definitely do it on the pitching side. But even then, I wouldn't feel totally comfortable about it. I've had a lot of success in mono formats, usually by having a pretty, you know, risk-averse approach, spread the wealth, don't have any real stars and scrubs approach at all. So, you know, usually I stick to the more shallow formats in terms of having the stars and scrubs type theme, and I stay pretty even whenever I'm doing any of the mono formats.
Good, Mike. What are your thoughts on stars and scrubs versus a balanced approach?
Well, I agree with all that in the mixed leagues. What I'll say in the mono leagues, and this is kind of how I built my reputation before I got into tout, and then when I was in at the beginning, I'm very much a where the room takes you kind of person. And what that means is that in a room that's being aggressive, so the CBS only auctions or mono auctions, I don't know if you guys are familiar with those or not. Mm-hmm. So they're very aggressive and people spend a lot early. I'll tend to hang back and I'll wind up with a balanced team. And like this year, for example, the most, it was NL only, the most expensive guy I got was Yoenis Cespedes at 26. And it was a very balanced team across the board, and the pitching was low end. And on the other side of that, you know, in tout in 2015 when I won, it was a stars and scrubs team. I got Kershaw at 37. I got Paul Goldschmidt at 37. I got another player, like, you know, kind of high, not that high, but like in the high 20s. And both can work. You know, it really comes down to what's going on in the auction. And what's tough in an expert auction is it moves so quickly that you don't have time to sit there. You know, in a home league, it's like, okay, this is going slowly. Mm-hmm. I can look at my sheet. I can think about what's going on. I can, you know, look at what the other owners are doing. Like tout and labor go so quickly. It's like, okay, well, I've got to like pretty much just do these things now and worry about them later. But, you know, in like tout was a good example in 2015. So the guys I was able to back up with, you know, I mentioned Galvis, you know, I got him cheap. I got, you know, Hecheverria cheap, which, you know, again, in a mixed league, it is just ridiculous. But in a mono league in 2015, he was good. You know, Solarte, I got cheap that year. He was really good. If you can build if your scrubs are those guys, those everyday players in a mono who don't do much, but they're playing every day, they can produce like 8, 10, 12 bucks worth of stats. And you get three guys like that between $1 to $3 or $4, your stars can just kind of hit the levels they're supposed to hit, and you're going to win. So it really comes down to what, in a mono league, it really comes down to what everybody else is doing. Like if people are being super aggressive and pushing those stars up to like 45, 50 bucks, you know, without inflation. You know, I noticed on your agenda, we're not even talking about keeper leagues, but, you know, if you're in a startup league and there's no inflation and people are going 45, 50 on those stars, hang back. Like, you'll get your value later. If people are being too conservative, you know, if they're not going up to 40 on the stars, you know, like Brian or Goldie or an AL like Altuve or Betts, you know, just grab those guys and worry later about how you're going to fill at the bottom. Like if people being conservative early, what's going to wind up happening is people are going to overspend in the middle because they'll be afraid that they're not going to spend all their money.
And I think that's a really good point. It's something I experienced last year in a industry league with you know, a couple guys like Lenny Melnick and a few other guys in it from the industry. And everybody went crazy at the beginning of the draft, and they were just overspending. It was AL only. You know, all the kind of top-tier guys went for $45, $50, and it left me without having a player on my roster after probably about 25 nominations because everybody was just spending their money. But I was able to clean up in the middle. There was a huge lull. I was able to take advantage of it, and it was because I did exactly what you just said. And that was, I waited and kind of allowed the draft to come, or the auction to come to me, and it did. Now, it didn't end up working out for me in terms of where I finished in the league, because unfortunately, I ended up getting a bunch of guys who were injured, and my pitching really took a hit. But it was the correct strategy, because everybody was, they fell in love with their guys, they bid them up, and made sure they got them at any price, and it left a lot of bargains. Some of which that Evil Mike took advantage of, and during that auction as well, and he finished up much higher than I did. Matt, any thoughts on this this approach, stars and scrubs versus a balanced?
Well, you know, I've been in both situations, and I find myself, if I do the stars and scrubs, it's kind of like what you guys said. It's just because of how the draft kind of fell to me. I'm very risk averse, and a lot of at the top end of my draft, and you know, the top end of the draft or the high dollar amounts you spend on guys are similar. So the big investment, I'm kind of risk averse. So I would tend more toward you know, 9 times out of 10, I'm going to be more balanced. But I mean, you never know how the draft goes. So, like you guys all said, it's you can have an idea of what you want to do until you get into that room, and then everything can change in a second.
All right, let's talk about some different strategies. First, I want to ask, good Mike, what's your thought on punting categories? Is this something you tend to employ? Is there a size or format that you prefer doing that in?
In a mixed league, I would avoid it. And especially in a 12-team mix or a 10-team, you don't want to start your draft one category down. Like, it's just not a good place to be. You know, mid-season, if you have injuries or, you know, like if you draft a Hamilton or buy a Hamilton and, you know, he gets injured, you might have to do it. But don't enter your draft or auction dumping categories. It's a bad play. In mono leagues, again, this goes back to what's happening in your auction. If you see, like, saves are really expensive or steals are really expensive, it's okay, like to do that, to say, well, you know what? It doesn't make sense for me to pay $5 or $10 over market on a player to compete in a category if it's going to cost me in every other category. That's really what it comes down to. I see too many people have the philosophy in a deep mix or a mono league of, like, I have to compete in every category. And what they don't realize is, like, well, if you're spending, you know, $35 on a second tier closer just to compete in saves, you're better off just not buying the saves and hoping you get some. But if you don't get some, just dumping it. And in keeper leagues, this applies even more. Like, you really don't want to be in a position where you're like, okay, I have to get, you know, of the five closers out there in my auction, I have to get one of those closers. You know, I was in a situation years ago where I was in a league where there were, I think it was an NL only, there were four or five closers available. One of them was Jose Mesa. This is back when Jose Mesa was, like, you know, not very good at that point in his career. And somebody paid like 32 for him. And I sat there, you know, I sat there watching this, and I needed a closer. And I think I bid like 20 or 22. And I just, it kept going. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to dump saves. I'm not going to spend all this money on a Jose Mesa to maybe get saves and cost my team, like, in every other category. Like, that just doesn't play.
All right. Evil Mike, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I tend to agree. I'm never going to go into a draft just automatically punting a category. Now, I will say this, you know, letting auctions come to you, if saves are going insanely high and you're not willing to, you know, go in that range, then absolutely, yeah, let the, you know, draft kind of, you know, just let saves go if you're going to be that way. But at the same time, like, if I see myself falling behind in saves and I have a, you know, surplus at a certain, in a certain category, and I know that the league is kind of, you know, very friendly and everybody likes to trade a lot of the time, then, you know, I'll add to that surplus. You know, that way I can, you know, use that as leverage to another owner whenever I'm doing trade negotiations and stuff like that. That happened last season with me in stolen bases. I ended up having a massive surplus out of the draft. And yes, I did have to kind of, you know, make sure that I dealt one of those players, but I was able to fairly easily, and then I was able to kind of even everything out in terms of the categories. You know, wins is something that I will punt, not because that's just such a volatile thing, but the main things that I will never punt is power, because you get so much in terms of the hitters that do provide power for you in terms of the runs and the RBIs and, you know, just the counting stats, that I feel like that is never something that you should be interested in punting ever. If you were to punt any type of category at all, I would make it, you know, stolen bases. That's also assuming that you have a few guys on your team that could steal a few anyways, but you know, just pure speed stirs, I would be willing to punt, and, you know, maybe saves, wins, maybe even batting average, because that's volatile as well. But in general, I don't ever go into a draft or auction assuming I'm going to punt a category.
Matt, what are your thoughts on punting categories? Are you a fan?
Yeah, no, not at all. Like, I'm gonna echo what these guys said, man. Saves is the one that, you know, you go into it, and I'm just like, I'm not gonna pay those prices. And I'm glad Mike brought up you know, keeper formats. If you're in a keeper or dynasty startup draft and you don't get one of the top five closers, just wait. Don't even mess with the middle pack, because, I mean, you look at guys who were in the middle of the closer tier 3 years ago, who you got guys like, what, Glenn Perkins, Trevor Rosenthal. I mean, what good are they for you now in those formats? So if you don't get one of the top guys, a Chapman, a Jansen, a Britton, a guy that you know isn't going anywhere, don't even mess with saves. Just get guys that have skills, not the roles. But speed guys are easy to punt because I feel like you can get those one category speedsters a little bit later if you want to play that game. I know, Justin, I know you've had great success punting batting average. This is not one I can find myself being able to do. So I don't know. It's different in every league and every format you're in. You just need to know, and you need to be familiar with, you know, how you guys in your league operate. So just know that.
Yeah, as mentioned, I think a couple times already that I'm a huge advocate, not necessarily advocate, but I tend to punt average in a lot of leagues, or at least devalue it. There's such a variance in year to year for a lot of guys in terms of where their averages end up. For me, I like to devalue it to a point where it's not really playing a huge role in my valuations. And I do this because I'm not going to take a zero more than likely in that category because of it. I try to hopefully then finish somewhere in the middle of the pack, but it gives me the ability to kind of load up in other areas. I do punt saves on occasion, but it is very auction dependent. Like you guys mentioned, it's not something I necessarily go into an auction outside of keeper leagues where a lot of closers are already kept, maybe at a cheap price. It's not something I necessarily plan to do otherwise. So, but batting average is something I do tend to punt a lot, especially in mono leagues. I know that some people really dislike that strategy, but for me, I found a lot of success doing it because of the variance in it.
Yeah, and that the year before I won Tout in 2014, that was a winner for Tristan Cockcroft, you know, who had before I won had won 3 years in a row, and the last year he won, like, that was his thing. He tanked batting average, and I would agree. In mono leagues, it's a good strategy if you do it well.
Mm-hmm. Chris Davis hit 286 one time, people.
Well, you know, and one of the guys, you know, that I like to tend to point out with this as an example is if you look at, like, Todd Frazier's batting averages over the course of his career. I mean, he's a guy that's hit 273, then 234, then 273, then 255, then last year at 225. I mean, good luck trying to project where his batting average is going to end up.
Well, you know what it is? It's that if you buy those the bad batting average guys, because people look at their, you know, people always pay for last year's stats. Mm-hmm. Whether it's a draft or auction, it's one of those ugly secrets. Like, we're not supposed to be biased, but we are.
Yeah,
and it's human nature. Like, we look at what a player did last year, and we build a lot of their value off of that, versus looking prospectively at what they're going to do. So batting average really drives that. And yes, you're getting a bunch of bad batting average hitters, but because of variability, whether it's BABIP or whether it's because a player bounces back, you're not going to win batting average. What you're hoping to do is finish middle of the pack, mm-hmm. in the category or a little bit worse. And then everything else, you know, the home runs, the runs batted in, the ribbies, that all bounces up. And that's what the strategy is.
Yep. Let's go ahead and I want to know if there's any of you guys have an outside-the-box strategy. I'll start this one off. I'm a big fan of the Labadini plan.
God, and if I have to do Labadini again.
It's not so much because it's a fantastic strategy, but it's just really fun. And for those who don't know what the Labadini plan is it spending a dollar on each one of your pitchers and then the rest of your money on your offense. It's extremely unique, and you tend to then crush everybody in offense, hopefully get lucky with some, $1 relievers that turn into closers, and then halfway through the season, trade for some elite starting pitchers from your dominant offense. I've used it with varying levels of success. Sometimes it seems to really kind of help me kind of get a jump start on the offensive side, and then I'm able to catch up in the pitching categories later on. And then sometimes it's an absolute disaster, but I'll tell you, it is a ton of fun. Good, Mike. Do you have any outside the box strategies that you like?
Again, in startup leagues, I tend to go where the auction takes me, so it's mm-hmm. not necessarily, you know, something I try to do. I don't know if there's a really I'll more back into a strategy than like play something like that. So there was one year in Tout where I didn't quite do a Labadini, but I wound up with a $37 pitching staff and I finished second. You know, and some of that was like the pitchers that the low end pitchers I bought paid off. I fabbed again, this NL only. I fabbed it was Mujica the year he closed with the Cardinals. I fabbed him early. And, you know, this is like La Russa, like Sunday at like 10:30 at night, like announced he's a closer. And I was like one of two people who was like on that. And, you know, I had the more aggressive bid. But yeah, so I do like the low end pitching strategy, although not to that extreme. I've gone the other way, too. I've gone in the direction of spending a lot on pitching. And this works better in old school 4x4 leagues, but it can work in a 5x5. Where you dump power. What I kind of say about a lot of these boutique strategies, I prefer them in keeper leagues where you're kind of forced into them if you have a weak keeper list and you're deficient in a category. In redraft expert leagues, I kind of prefer just to play straight up, and it's only when the auction's in the middle or later that I might try to like tweak things a little bit.
Matt, any outside-the-box strategies you like?
Not really, man. I'm not as adverse in the auction formats as you guys are. I mean, I probably pick up one or two auction leagues a year, so I just kind of play it straight. And I watch other strategies look interesting. I think this year, Justin, I think the Labadini does sound interesting, and it actually, I mean, this year more than others, it seems kind of doable because how many pitchers you can get late. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? For decent value, but. Other than that, I really haven't tried any of these. I'd be anxious to do it, but I don't know if I would have the fortitude to pull it off, to be honest.
And, you know, we were talking prior to recording, and I said, if somehow I end up in the mixed head-to-head Tout draft or auction, I will try to pull off a Labadini or a modified Labadini, unless Evil Mike, you know, takes control of the team. Evil Mike, what are you have any favorite outside-the-box strategies?
Take control of the team, I would do, because I do not condone the Labadini plan at all. That's insane.
Come on.
It's insane. if I were to do a strategy, it's always in, you know, it always will be the Lima plan. And that essentially, it's kind of like the Labadini, but not nearly as extreme. You, you know, take pretty much allocate, if you're in a, you know, say $260 budget league, you allocate $200 of the money to offense. And then, you know, the majority of your money on pitching towards pretty elite, you know, skilled closers for the most part. That way you're kind of dominating all the hitting categories. And then you also dominate, you know, ERA, WHIP, and you know, saves as well. So you automatically are kind of essentially punting two categories there. But at the same time, you have such a head start in all of those other eight categories that, you know, you're willing to take the risk there. Mind you, I don't really practice out of the box strategies a lot. I stay, you know, fairly risk averse when I'm doing auctions, just because I really don't like to go past my valuations on players. I spend a lot of time doing them. I use a lot of resources to do that, a lot of time. And whenever I'm in an auction, I tend to stay fairly true to them. So that usually doesn't end up with me going out of the box a lot.
All right. Well, that is going to wrap up our discussion on auction strategies for today. We'll move into recent MLB moves here right after this quick break.
It's that time again. That's right. It's fantasy baseball season, and the Fantasy Black Book is back and better than ever. This is Joe Pisapia, author of the 9-time best-selling Fantasy Black Book series, number one right now on Amazon, on iTunes, and for the first time ever, the Fantasy Baseball Black Book can be held in your hand. Yes, what a beautiful world we live in. Head over to Amazon and buy your hard copy as well today. Baseball is coming. Are you ready?
All right, let's go ahead and jump into some recent MLB moves. We are talking on Monday night, and a few hours ago, there was an announcement of a trade that kind of came a little bit out of nowhere. We know the Dodgers had been looking at a second baseman. I think a lot of us thought it would be Brian Dozier of the Twins. But Evil Mike's team, the Rays, trade Logan Forsyth to the Dodgers for Jose De Leon. So I'll let you start, Evil Mike. What do you think of this trade, Logan, and then Logan Forsyth's value in L.A.?
Yeah, so I was kind of shocked when I saw this. I didn't know. It was interesting at first. And then, you know, the more I kind of thought about it, the more I didn't fall in love with it, but I'm okay with it. Forsythe is somebody that we originally acquired from Jesse Hahn. So if you think about it, the Rays traded Jesse Hahn over to the Padres along with Torres, I believe, and ended up getting Forsythe, Matt Andrees, and Brad Boxberger in the deal. And then the Rays, a couple of years later, they ship off Forsythe, and they end up getting 6 years of really nice, cost-controlled Jose De Leon. And I like that, from a ball club perspective. Now, from a fantasy perspective for this year, I think Forsythe is still going to be a really nice fantasy commodity. Since he got 500 plus at bats with the Rays, 2 years ago, he's essentially been a top 10 second baseman. He's top 8 in home runs over the last two seasons. He's been top 10 in runs scored. It looks like he's projected to sit on top of the Dodgers lineup, at least according to Roster Resource right now. That's also subject to change. We don't really know, but at the end of the day, if Logan Forsythe gets 500 plus at bats, then he's going to get 15 plus home runs. He's going to hit for a solid batting average, and he's going to get on base. So from a fantasy perspective, I think that he is still a solid contributor, probably more of a middle infielder in 15 team mixed formats. But in mono leagues, he's definitely a starting second baseman in NL only. I think that that's a solid place for him. And he's also very affordable in drafts as well. He's going right now at about pick 250 in NFBC. And I don't really see that trending upward too much as well. So I like the deal from a fantasy perspective, because I think that it doesn't really change his value too much. In terms of Jose De Leon, I don't know if we really want to cover that much, but I think that the Rays, got a really nice pitcher here. I think that he might get, overvalued in fantasy still, but I do like the player.
Matt, what are your thoughts on Forsythe going to LA and then Jose De Leon going to Tampa?
I think for Forsythe, I don't know where he's going to hit in the lineup, so that's interesting to me. I don't think he hits 20 homers again. I mean, the line drives are strong, though, a lot of hard contact. And like Mike said, he's practically one of the most underrated players in the game. He gets overlooked a lot. So, it's a very solid get for the Dodgers, and I think they did well here. De Leon is interesting to me. I wrote him up, with I had him number 2 in the Dodgers system. He was really close to number 3. I probably should have dropped him to 3 in hindsight. Because, it's weird that the team's trying to move him so much. He seemed to be involved in every deal they have. And you would think with a starting pitching depth, with what the Dodgers, all the injuries they had last year, you think they would value the starting pitching depth a little more. Yes, they still have Brock Stewart. But now it's Brock Stewart and Brandon McCarthy are their depth, which is kind of scary for them. Excuse me. But, for De Leon, I think, he's got the fastball. It's deceptive. The velocity is not premium from the right side, but it's low 90s, low 90s, high 80s sometimes even. The changeup is his best pitch. But the thing with De Leon is he's an extreme fly ball tendency guy. He doesn't have a really good breaking ball yet to establish that. So I'm a little worried about him leaving the NL West and going to the AL East, because now he's going to have to pitch in Yankee Stadium, Fenway Park, Camden Yards, and Toronto. Those aren't very easy parks to pitch, and every one of those teams has a lineup that can get you whenever. So it's I think De Leon's value goes down a tick for the long term. I'd probably bump him down to a fantasy number 3 guy because of the ballparks. The strikeouts, I think, are going to stay probably little more than 1 per inning. He's not going to walk a lot of guys. He throws a lot of strikes. He actually led the minor leagues in K percentage minus walk percentage, which is actually a really good predictor of major league success. So that's something to look for. But I think he's more solid than star at this point for De Leon. Still a nice get, but
good, Mike. What are your thoughts on these moves?
I agree with what pretty much everybody said for the most part. Forsythe he's an underrated asset, and I wouldn't say I was all in on him coming into last year, but I thought he could hold his gains, and a lot of people thought he was a flash in the pan. I'm a little bit higher on De Leon than some are. He profiles for me as kind of a number 3, as a mid-tier guy. I have a feeling, looking at the Rays and their depth chart, that he could start in the minors. He has the options, and he might wind up as their first guy to replace either an injured or ineffective pitcher. Something about all this, the one thing I'll add, a deeper league and mono sleeper, we've been talking about mono leagues, is Nick Franklin. Nick Franklin's only 26 years old, baseball age 26 years old. He showed some good power last year. This opens a door for him, assuming they don't sign a free agent, which I know they still might. They're linked to Chris Carter, although the Rays are pretty, you know, they pinch pennies. But if Franklin can find a way into the lineup, even as a part-timer in a monoleague, I kind of like that power. And, you know, that's something to monitor, particularly if you're having an early draft and you're, you know, going to be drafting in, like, late this month or early February.
Yeah, that was something I was going to bring up, Nick Franklin, but also the fact that I think the Rays aren't done in terms of moves. I think they are going to sign a first baseman, whether it be a guy like Chris Carter or Brandon Moss, someone who could play first, and then they can slide Brad Miller over to play second, and then still have kind of some mobility with a guy like Nick Franklin within their infield and outfield. So I don't think the Rays are done, but if for some reason this is their roster going into opening day, then I would agree Nick Franklin would have a lot of kind of sleeper and underrated value coming into the season, especially in the mono formats. You know, in terms of De Leon, I think this is really nice for his short-term value. I don't know how I feel about it necessarily. I'm not as high on him in terms of his long-term value right now. I don't love the move to the American League East. It's, you know, while Tampa's not a bad place necessarily to pitch in, the rest of the parks in that division are. It's still moving from the National League to the American League. I think there are some reasons to be concerned about his ceiling in terms of where we thought it would be last year or before. So I think that people are probably going to overdraft him because I do think he has a better shot of making the Major League rotation early on in the season in Tampa than he did in Los Angeles, where he was blocked by a lot of free agents that they had picked up, by other prospects within the system. I think he would have had a hard time getting in and sticking in the rotation with the Dodgers, which I don't think he'll have as hard of a time with the Rays. You know, in terms of Forsythe, I love the move for Forsythe to the Dodgers. It's going to be a very interesting lineup, a very nice lineup, batting behind him, especially if he is going to be leading off like Roster Resource projects. Even if he's not, I really like the move. You know, the park isn't great in terms of hitting for power, but I think the amount of run scores he could get in the one or two spot would more than make up for it. And I love Forsythe as a guy who's underrated. Like Mike said, he's currently going as the number 19th second baseman off the board behind Starlin Castro in front of Neil Walker. I love that value, and he's a guy that is going to end up on a number of my teams this year.
So that's a little added nugget to this trade. Do you think maybe someone like Jack Peterson's OBP or Andrew Toll's, you know, high contact against righties becomes a leadoff guy in L.A.? A little added value for those two?
I mean, you know, to steal Matthew Berry's old line, it feels like to me like they have a Mott like hate, intensity hate for Jock Peterson at times, because I think he would be a fantastic you know, person for the leadoff.
I think that was more with Mattingly though. I don't know if Dave Roberts has that same.
Why would you cut Forsythe out of the leadoff spot though? He's done great as a leadoff hitter for the Rays. Andrew Friedman is the old, you know, president of operations for the Rays. He obviously acquired, you know, Forsythe in the first place. Like, he knows what his skill set is. I don't think that changes. I do want to just add something with the Rays because, you know, Mike talked about Nick Franklin, and I think that that's a great name. He had a couple months last year where he actually did very well, and he actually started to tap into some of that power that he always had in the minor leagues. He actually had a really nice month in terms of strikeout rate and walk rate as well. So he started to figure out some things at the plate, which is really encouraging. And I think that one of the bigger, you know, especially in deeper formats and keeper leagues, Daniel Robert, I think he'll make his way up this year. I think Tim Beckham is a no name. So, you know, the fact that Roster Resource has Beckham as a backup infielder right now, I either see him starting in the minors or maybe even getting DFA'd. He is only a right-handed bat off the bench, not somebody that's fantasy viable. I think Daniel Robinson probably makes his way up sometime, you know, in the first couple months of the season. Willie Adames might make a appearance sometime later in the year as well. But Franklin also played the outfield 17 games he played in left field last season, which is nice in terms of fantasy value because he has different eligibility, but also is nice in terms of adding adding versatility to the Rays and being able to bring up one of those middle infield options that they have. I think it's a certainty that they sign Chris Carter and shift Brad Miller over to second base if I had to bet on it now. But at the same time, if they were to go into the season now, there's no way that Colby Rasmus is their full-time left fielder.
All right. Let's go ahead and move on. I don't want to talk about Luis Valbuena signing with the Angels. Good Mike, any interest in him in deeper formats?
Yeah, in deeper formats, I wouldn't mind him as my third corner at the right price. I don't see him in a full-time role. I know Yunel Escobar, who plays third, isn't that inspiring from a fantasy perspective, but I see Valbuena more as a swing utility guy. Something to watch there. You know, Albert Pujols is coming off of foot surgery. He's someone to monitor as to whether or not he'll make it to opening day. He probably will, but given his age, given the history with that injury and some of the issues he's had there before, he could miss some time, which would open the door for Valbuena either first base or DH. To me, he is an AL only at this point. I don't see him having much value anywhere else. I don't have anything against him. I just think he's kind of blocked. Now, if you're in an on-base league like Towers is, Valbuena picks up a little bit more interest because he walks a lot, and that's a skill that he has. But otherwise, he's a mono kind of back-end guy for me, even with the signing.
I think that's very fair. I mean, he's a guy that could be interesting, especially if they do maybe try to get him some at-bats in the outfield, but I just don't know if he can play left field anymore at this stage in his career. He does have some pop. I mean, hit 25 home runs in 2015, was definitely down quite a bit last year, but got, you know, almost 150 less plate appearances. Matt, what are your thoughts on Luis Valbuena moving to Los Angeles?
Yeah, you guys nailed it. I think with Pujols maybe missing some time, I think he's an insurance policy there. He's a nice corner. First base, third base, power bat, OBP leagues. He needs a big boost. It's worth noting, and I doubt he can still play the position, but he played some second base as early as 2014, so I don't know if that's still a thing. The Angels kind of – I know they just traded for Espinoza, but he can move around the diamond too. So he'll have a little bit of value toward the end of the drafts. Like you said, you could do worse, but don't expect any batting average, but if he plays a full season's worth of at-bats, you can look for 20 to 25 homers, that's for sure.
Evil Mike, any thoughts on Valbuena?
Yeah, I mean, I'll pretty much just echo what you guys said. I think that he is a back-end, you know, AL-only play. I will say he, you know, does fairly well against righties. He has a 256-plus batting average in two of the last 3 years against righties and, you know, 14% walk rate against them last season as well. I think if you are going to pencil in 300 at-bats for him, that's fair. You know, if you're kind of projecting more than that, then I think you're kind of, you know, getting a little bit risky. But I think that that's about where you should sit with him.
All right. Let's move on to a little bit more exciting signing. That was Michael Saunders kind of surprisingly ending up in Philadelphia. Good Mike, you live in the Philadelphia area. What are your thoughts on Saunders now a Philly?
I like Saunders. You know, the power was there with him. One of the things that appealed with Saunders in the past was that he was a power speed guy. It wasn't like he was a 30-30 guy, but, you know, he hit some home runs. He stole some bases. Last year, those steals disappeared. And given the injury history with him, given the profile, I'm okay with him in a deeper mix as a back-end pick. But between his injury history and the fact he doesn't run, and, you know, honestly, with you know, Roman Quinn, whose speed really intrigues me, and this pushes him out the door. And to a lesser degree, Alan Altair. I don't get too excited about Saunders. I could see him hitting, you know, 20 home runs at CBP. But as you were talking about before with power, it's not quite the same contextually as it was a few years ago. We're like, oh, you know, 20 home runs, 25 home runs from an outfielder. That's really something excited about. Now I look at that like, yeah, you know, that's good and you want that on your team, but it's not necessarily something that's special. You know, another thing you mentioned, the Phillies, CBP a few years ago was a home run park. And now the last couple of years, it's profiled more as home run neutral. So I like Saunders. I think he'll be a solid addition in real life. But in fantasy, you know, I don't see him as a significant impact guy. The other thing I'll add is that the current projected roster, it looks like it's going to be a platoon for him with Aaron Altair. So that's good for Saunders' batting average. But in terms of playing time, being a full-time guy, that's not likely to be in the cards for him, even if he does stay healthy.
And I think that's a really good point because he could get platooned with Altair. And then he also was really awful in the second half of the season. And that may have been due to injuries, but we're talking about now a guy who is no longer young. He's entering his age 30 season, has a ton of injury issues, and now going to be playing in the National League where he's not going to be able to be hidden on as a DH when he's kind of banged up and nicked up. He's going to have to play. I was all in on Michael Saunders last year. I think I did fairly well because of it in seeing the fact that he hit 24 home runs and did fairly well, even though he did struggle down the stretch. But to me in Philadelphia, platoon issues and injury history, I'm probably not going to end up with him a lot unless his price stays where it's currently at because it is extremely low. But I think that has a lot to do with the fact that a lot of the drafts that are played into the ADP happened prior to him signing. So I could see his draft value skyrocketing. Evil Mike, what are your thoughts on Michael Saunders?
I am surprised that you were that low on Michael. Year. I'm sitting there like in awe. I don't even know what to say after that. Like, thank you for actually, coming on board the right train for once. as much as I like really hate on Saunders, I had him on a ton of rosters last season and it definitely paid off, especially in the first half. But I just don't see what he did against lefties repeating this season. And, Gianella already said that, Citizens Bank is pretty much playing neutral, especially the left-handed power over the last 3 years. I don't think that he stays healthy. I also think that he's going to be in a platoon based on, their roster. They have a couple of intriguing guys there on their bench. It's just a lot of things that I just don't. He also has contact problems. There's just a lot of things that kind of go against Saunders, especially in Philly. So I'm pretty much out unless the cost is so bad that I can acquire him for literally nothing, which is where he's going right now. But if I'm in NL only, that's more or less where I would be kind of targeting him. And at that point, it would still need to be very cheap.
All right, Matt, what are your thoughts on Michael Saunders?
You guys nailed it, man. I was going to say how bad he was in the second half. He stayed off the DL, but, he was actually a hindrance to the Blue Jays last year in the second half. He actually hit lefties way better than righties. I don't expect that to repeat, but that's actually – in 2015, he did the same thing, but it was a really small sample because he got hurt really soon. But he hit lefties better against than righties there too. So I don't know how much stock you want to take in two separate cases of small sample size, but we'll see about all that. He's going 387 per NFBC. Obviously, a lot of that was before, he signed with Philly, so before he had a role. He'll be going higher now, but still not much, enough to pay much for him. But I do think if you can work Saunders in as a late option, you can do worse. So I take him as a late option, but I'm not investing any more than a buck or two.
All right, we're going to talk about two more guys real quick. First, Dan Straley, who's traded to the Marlins. Good Mike, what are your thoughts on Straley in Miami?
Well, I saw, I don't know if you guys mentioned him on the show or pre-podcast, but I saw, Paul Spohr of Fangraphs was, I don't say he's high on Straley, but he's mentioning a lot of the positives. He's moving to a very good pitcher's park as opposed to a very bad one, particularly for home runs, and Straley's a fly ball pitcher. I'm okay with Straley, but I have a feeling I'm not going to own him in a lot of leagues. I get the park switch. That's going to help him. The division's going to help him. But he's losing Billy Hamilton, which is something nearly nobody has pointed out. And he's getting an outfield that even by the most generous metrics is kind of average in terms of its defense. He's a fly ball guy. So, yeah, home runs are worse than doubles or triples, but some of that's going to play into Straley's numbers. I can see him maintaining what he did last year in terms of the earned run average. even though the FIP or the DRA or whatever advanced metric you want to use wasn't as kind to him. But I don't really want to push him too high. He's kind of a back-end deep mix guy for me and really more of an only play still. I know the numbers are really good last year. I know he's still relatively young. I just don't see any real improvement in his peripherals or in his stuff, quite honestly, that makes me want to push him past that point in a draft or auction.
Matt, what are your thoughts on Straley?
As a prospect guy, man, I've really liked Straley. You watch him through the years, consistently in the minor leagues, he's a 10.5 K per 9 guy. And obviously that hasn't translated to the major leagues because the pitching in the major leagues is hard. So you have to do a little bit of adjustment for that. But, I mean, he got a little lucky last year. He led the NL in home runs given up. He gave up 31 homers in Cincinnati. Obviously, I think being in Miami is better for that. But like Mike said, I mean, it's a huge outfield. He's losing his best defensive outfielder, probably maybe in baseball almost, with Hamilton. He's in the conversation, that's for sure. And he got a little lucky. Like I said, a lot of the home runs he gave up, like 80% of them were solo shots. So that's lucky in itself. But the walks are a smidge high. I'm a little bit lower on Straley than I have been in years past, but I think this is a positive move for him. So NL only league, I wouldn't be afraid to invest.
I think this is a positive move for him, but I agree with you, Matt, that he got lucky, and that to me kind of counterbalances the fact that he's getting the park move. And I think that's an amazing point, good Mike, on not having Billy Hamilton, getting a little bit of a worse defense to play in that outfield. I don't think I really want anything to do with Straley. I think out of the three pitchers going in his in the same area as him on NFBC leagues from his own team, I think I'd rather have Chen and Conley over him. I think they have greater upside. Is it a positive move? Yes, but I could easily see him, not strand as many runners. He stranded like 81% of his of the runners he had on base last year. That to me is not going to repeat. Matt, like you said, the majority of his home runs he gave up were solo shots. That's probably not going to happen. I just don't see a ton to be really excited about. He doesn't have high strikeout rates, so you're not really getting a ton of help there. I mean, how exciting is a guy with a 3.75 ERA that doesn't get a ton of strikeouts? I mean, outside of NL only, I just don't see the upside for a guy like Straley. And you know, there probably will be a Paul Spohr or someone who is higher on him than me in most of the NL onlys I'm in. So yeah, I don't think Shirley's a guy I'm going to end up with a bunch.
It's funny that you said that. His xFIP is close to where you are. His xFIP was 5.02.
Yeah, and so, I mean, you know, look at his BABIP. I mean, he had a minuscule BABIP last
year. Yeah, he did. 239, yes.
So, I mean, I just don't see – you look at the underlying statistics, and I understand the park chain has changed – should help him with some of those, but I just, even if it helps a little bit, I mean, you're looking at a guy that's probably around a 4 ERA, and yep, that's kind of unusable in my estimation. So, Evil Mike, any thoughts on Straley?
Yeah, I don't know how I can have any thoughts. You guys just took like literally 19 of them and just ran away. You know, I think that just looking at him on the surface, you know, you guys have really covered everything. The stats from last year, even if they were to repeat, I just think that people would overpay because of the park change, which is understandable. I mean, he is getting a significant boost in ballpark, but, you know, again, I'll just, you know, reiterate the point that Mike made is the Billy Hamilton defense loss is a vast one. And I'd also think that, you know, his, you know, home run problem is not going to leave just because he's going to a more pitcher friendly ballpark. You know, of those 31 home runs last year, 24 of them were solo shots. So it could have been much worse. You know, thanks to Baseball HQ for pointing that out as well. But it's, I think that it's going to be even worse than last season, even though he's getting a better ballpark.
All right. Last guy we're going to talk about today is Neftali Feliz signing with the Brewers. Evil Mike, is he the closer in Milwaukee, and do you care?
I think I would say right now, if I'm drafting, I would pencil him in as the closer, just, you know, based on the fact that he, you know, had some a lot of high leverage situations last year. You know, obviously Ray Searidge was his pitching coach last season as well, and he was able to kind of correct some things. The walks are still a bit of an issue for me, but the fact that he's still getting, you know, last season he got 15% swing strike rate, which was a career high. I think that that will somewhat stick. I don't think it'll be a career high again, but the fact that he's trending back up to, you know, 96 miles an hour and he's missing more bats definitely is what I like to see in closers. When you look at the other candidates, I do like Corey Knebel, or however you pronounce his name. I like him, but that's pretty much the only other guy that is currently on roster that I would have, you know, taken any type of shot with. You know, maybe Carlos Torres, but I'm not nearly as high on him. So I think that they signed him to be their closer, and if I'm going in drafts right now, I would kind of pencil him in as a guy that can get 30 saves if everything broke right. I do think he's also a candidate to get traded at some point if, you know, he does do well. Maybe not, but you know, right now his ADP doesn't really reflect where he's going to go in drafts. It's, you know, outside the top 450, and I think that as drafts move along, you're going to see him, you know, definitely in the top 250 or so. So if you're willing to, you know, kind of take him as a second closer for your team, I'm okay with that. But if you start seeing him, you know, hit the middle of the closer pool, then that's where I kind of would probably be out.
Good, Mike. What are your thoughts on Feliz signing in Milwaukee?
Well, he'll close. Yeah, the bullpen behind him, there's always some intriguing arms, but, you know, they brought him in to close. I went back and looked at his numbers over the last 3 years, and he's just not impressive. Like, he has moments, and he certainly can strike guys out, but between the health and just the consistency or lack thereof, he's a lower end option for me as a closer. You certainly want him in, you know, 15 team mixed or an only league, but he's not one of the first guys off the board. You know, I think he'll be fine. And there's enough variability with relievers that, you know, if he finishes, you know, we saw this with Fernando Rodney last year, particularly in the first half. If Feliz finishes in the top 15, I won't be surprised, because, you know, it's you're talking about a small sample with relievers. But in terms of what I expect, he's just not somebody I'm banking on.
Yeah, I mean, you look at some of the numbers that he put up last year with the Pirates, and yes, the overall results weren't bad, but he also stranded over 85%. He is moving to a worse park. He's got injury issues. He walked 3.5 per 9. I think there could be quite a blow up. Plus, how long will he hold the closer position for?
Well, that's the other thing I was going to point out, which is the catch 22 with him is that if he stinks or he's erratic, you know, that they didn't pay him a ton of money. They'll just use, you know, Knebel or someone else. If he does really well, you know, unless the Brewers somehow manage to, you know, sneak into wild card contention, he's a trade candidate. He's a trade candidate. So really, yeah, I know. In that division, too, it's kind of tough between the Cubs and the Cardinals.
Yeah, there's no way. They're out already. There's no way.
I you know, the team itself is – if you just look at the team and not the division, I think they'll be better than some people think. Mm-hmm. But that probably means like 75 to 80 wins. You know, it doesn't mean wild card.
They have no pitching. They're starting
rotation. Well, that's exactly it. That's
the worst thing I've ever seen, like legitimately.
Josh Hader's coming though, bro.
Well, no, the Padres –
well, the Padres are worse, yeah. The Padres are worse.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. just you know, I know I'm veering off, but in NL only, you know, I did my preliminary bids, and I don't have a single Padres pitcher with a bid, and this is only over $1. And I've never, except for the Rockies, like in the 90s when, you know, they were expansion team and it was Colorado and, you know, the old bad pitching staffs, I've never had that happen.
No Junior Guerra, even for like $3?
No, I'm talking about the Padres.
Oh, sorry.
I've got a few Brewers over $1. I mean, I don't think they're that bad, but the Padres, you look at that rotation, it's like...
Padres is even worse, yeah. It's bad.
Yeah, even if they signed Jared Weaver, who they've been linked to, I don't think I'd even give him more than
Brandon Morrow return? Is he going to return to the rotation? That'd be a welcome, you know, shot from the past.
you know, the current... Here's a fun exercise. Without looking at the depth chart, can you name the Padres, like, rotation?
I know they have a chassis.
I think I can.
I can because I did their preview and it was Tristan a really Friedrich. Depressing. Yes.
Luis Perdomo.
Not currently in it.
Actually, he's not currently in it, but that's a pretty good.
Yeah, yes. He should be.
Trevor Cahill.
Yes. Yep.
And you already said Chassin.
Yeah, yep. Chassin's in. I know
so
that.
That's four, right?
I think that's three. Perdomo's four, and he's not in.
Yeah, Perdomo is technically on the bubble right
now. Who's over Perdomo?
Well, we spent a long time on the Padres preview talking about how bad Paul Clemens is.
Oh, no. Paul Clemens? He's sliding the rotation?
Yeah, and then he's not. And then Clayton Richard is the other
that's
guy.
Right. I saw something on it'll get better, I guess. I saw something on Twitter that says they offered Jared Weaver $1.5 million to sign or something. So
don't they have Jared Kosar? Like, why don't they throw him in the rotation? I mean, he's at least as good as Paul Clemens.
He's too focusing on his poker game and I guess.
Is Kosar there though? Because I'm looking at their minor league depth chart and I don't even see him there.
He's a long relief.
Oh, okay. That's why. So. Yeah, I'm looking at the minors. You got Perdomo. You got Zach Lee, who they picked up on waivers. You got Cesar Vargas. Even the minor league options, you're kind of like.
They got Tyrell Jenkins off of.
Colin Ray's on the DL, right?
Diddleston LeMay, in terms of prospects, is the most promising guy who, he was ninth on the Padres' top 10 list for BA. But he's probably more of a 2018 guy. It's just I know we veered off here, but we were talking about auctions before. To bring this full circle, that's one of the biggest challenges I see in deep leagues this year is the pitching. Some of the rotations this year are bad. I know tonight they're doing the FSTA. Even in deeper mixed, there's a drop off from those top like 25-30 pitchers to the rest. Like it's really pronounced this year compared to some seasons. And that's one thing I can see my strategy being altered a little bit, and that's why, like Justin, what you were talking about with Labadini, either that or, a plan where you grab that one ace and then just fill in like kind of makes some sense.
Yeah. I mean, especially I may try maybe even just, spending the money on two aces and then filling in with like kind of high upside relievers. They're cheap. And then try to just fill in throughout the season with starters, either through trades or fab. But I see what you mean. I mean, you look at some of these rotations, especially in the National League, and you're wanting quite a bit more.
The thing about the high leverage relievers, though, is I feel like everybody is kind of getting on board that train nowadays.
Sure,
like,
but there's
even
always guys that nobody like that emerge throughout the season that nobody really thought about.
Yeah,
you want a Padres pitcher to invest in more than a dollar in this year? Carter Kapps. Yep.
Yeah, he's interesting. And well, the thing about relievers, and this is something that doesn't get talked about. So with 12 man pitching staffs and 7 man relief corps, you've got 6 non closers. You can throw a buck down on so many different types of guys, and you can really go for skills. You can't do that with your whole staff. But you can do that with one or two guys, and you can find, hopefully find somebody who will fit the bill. And then with Fab, there's even more guys like that you can just keep making those plays. It's like anything else. You don't have to be right every time. You just need to be right like once or twice. Like that's all you need to really like make that difference.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, that is going to wrap us up for this episode. Good, Mike. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure. And as I always say, anytime you guys want me on, it'll be great. And, I heard you guys are a couple of you are coming to Tout Wars in March. So I look forward to meeting you.
Yeah. Friends of Fantasy Benefits are going to crash Tout Wars. Myself, Mike, and then Eli, I believe all three of us were renting a house somewhere in Manhattan. And we are going to crash Tout Wars.
We're busting through the doors with a boombox, and we're just going to let it ride.
all you participants better watch your food, because we may try to give someone food poisoning to get in.
The first thing I'm going to do when I touch down in New York is literally grab a slice of pizza. That's like literally the first thing I'm going to do, because I want to know if the hype is real.
I live in Chicago, so there's no way it's better than Chicago.
I'm going to take a nap, because it's like a 5-hour trip for me.
Oh, wow.
So, all right, Mike, why don't you tell people again where you can be reached on Twitter and social media, and then give yourself some plugs.
Again, Twitter is Mike Gianella, and it's all one word. Last name is Gianella. Currently writing a baseball prospectus. Just to give all the BP plugs, it is subscription, but if you're going to subscribe for fantasy, this is the time of year to do it. We have about 20 articles a week. We're doing a position a week. This week we're doing second base. We expanded our staff, so there's about 14 writers right now. Additionally, we have a service called the Bat Signal, which is a little bit extra. But for that, that is a premium question answering service, and we will answer pretty much anything. Like, we get some dynasty questions that are, you know, the rate my roster questions that experts don't like to answer on Twitter. But you're paying for it, so we will answer those questions within 12 to 24 hours. So if you're that kind of person who's obsessive compulsive and plays in really deep leagues, that's a place to go.
All right, Matt, what are you working on, and where have you reached?
The Bat Signal is a really good tool because, you know, you play in a lot of leagues with guys on Twitter. You can't just be asking them stuff out in public, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, it's good stuff. Working on right now, we're doing the prospect minutes. Hopefully, everybody's enjoying them. We're getting a lot of positive feedback. And I've been writing little, top 10 guys in each organization that go along with it, coming out probably the morning afterwards. It's been a pretty nice system we had going here, and hopefully you're enjoying all the previews. Keep updating our fantasy rankings as we go along. And, Mike, thanks for coming on, man. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
Anytime, guys. Anytime.
All right, Evil Mike. Why don't you tell people what you're working on?
No, appreciate you coming on, Mike. And I, even though I get called Evil Mike, it's always awesome having you on the show. So appreciate it. You can catch me on Twitter at Mike Werner, FWFB. I'm getting ready to record a couple of new team preview shows with Yancey Eaton for the Rays show, which just became a lot more interesting now with this trade. And we're also going to have Teo Bedecht and Evan Peterson on for the Mariners show as well this week. So that'll be nice to do. Check out my stuff on baseballhq.com this upcoming year and Fantasy Pros as well.
Yeah, and then I'm on Twitter at Justin Mason, FWFB. I've got some more team previews with some guests. Howard Bender is going to do the Yankees with me. I believe Scott Bogman is going to do the Rangers. And then Chris McBrien is making his fantasy sports comeback just for an episode to talk about his Blue Jays with me. Those should be out later next week. Though the Howard Bender episode may end up coming out later this week, but we shall see. Then you can read all my writing right now on Fangraphs. We've got an article going up every week there. Have some more stuff going on friendsoffantasybenefits.com as well, including all of our ranks, which can also be found over at Fantasy Pros. Friends of Fantasy Benefits had a bunch of rankers that have been approved by Fantasy Pros to rank over there as well, so definitely check that out. Please give us a rate and review on iTunes, and if it's of the five-star variety, we will make sure you get into a listener league or are eligible to win other prizes that we'll be giving away later on in the offseason, as long as you send me a copy to friendsoffantasybenefits@gmail.com or at @fantasybenefits on Twitter. All right, that will wrap us up. For Mike, Matt, and myself, thank you for listening. Have a fantastic baseball season.
For Mike, Matt, and myself.